I'm just saying, Empire is still the best. It's the most complex, the most sophisticated. Wasn't afraid to have a dark ending.
Yeah, but come on, if it wasn't for the first one, you wouldn't have any of the rest of the movies.
Well, at least we can all agree the third one's always the worst.
And I'm gonna clap. All right.
And we haven't really talked about Furiosa, it occurs
to
me.
No, we haven't. Like,
pour one out for Praetorian Jack, oh, the last normal guy in the wasteland. You know, he was so normal.
He really was. And I love all of his, like, reactions to things, especially when that one, like, when Piss Boy blows himself up. He looks like, just like, no, wait, no, oh, come on.
Yeah, no, he was too normal to live in that apocalypse. Yeah, there's a lot of ideas going in that movie. That definitely felt like it's the opposite. It should have been like a 6-episode limited series, because it's like George Miller clearly has some 40-page storyboard about what's going on with those people in the holes down by the Citadel and what they're doing with the maggots.
Yep.
Like, there was a lot going on there, but they didn't seem like they were worth saving, maybe, in hindsight.
I don't know. I adore Furiosa, but it's also one of those things where I'm like, I totally understand why this didn't make a lot of money.
I didn't dislike it, but I've been thinking about it a lot, if that makes sense.
It does. I will say that a rewatch actually helps a lot, because when I first saw it, I was kind of like, wow, there's a lot going on here, and it's like very naughty, and there's like a lot of thematic stuff that it like kind of feels sort of all over the place.
It feels almost like they got to make the anime movie that like when Riddick got an anime movie, they got to actually make it for real.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like to me, because I'm also like, so where'd that other son go with the big forehead?
Well, apparently he was going to, he was going to figure into a big part of the other project that sort of spilled out of Fury Road's 20-year development process.
So in Fury Road, he's like on sabbatical.
I think he's dead. I think The Wasteland, the Mad Max movie that was also supposed to, you know, that was created during the Fury Road development, was going to detail how Max led into Fury Road. So
right.
I think,
but Furiosa leads directly into Fury Road.
Right, but you know, there's a time jump for that tree to grow at the end of Furiosa. So
that's true, and there is like a whole war that's just kind of glazed
it's
over.
Just yada
in
yada
montage.
Yada.
It was that almost felt like it was we ran out of money, like the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings. Hey, everybody. Welcome back once again to Podcast Part 3, the Part 3 Podcast. I am Sam.
And I am Will.
And I'm dragging my heels talking about Furiosa because once we get to the point, it's scumbag o'clock here at Podcast Part 3 because we are talking about X-Men The Last Stand. And as if that weren't punishment enough, we're talking about X-Men Apocalypse, the two sort of Part 3s. Directed by two of Hollywood's most celebrated creepers, and Will is smiling like a kid at Christmas, and I can't wait to get to the Halloween season so we can talk about horror movies.
No, I mean it's just always fun to talk X-Men movies with you, Sam. So, but
well,
I
both of these guys are confirmed pieces of shit, so yeah. I don't have to be super diplomatic about my thoughts on these movies.
Yes. No. You know, it is funny. You know, we were saying after Deadpool and Wolverine, how much nostalgia for a certain era of comic book movies that movie gave us. And then you watch X-Men The Last Stand and you're like, you know what? No, I'm glad this is done.
This is X-Men The Last Stand is I would say Goofus and Gallant, but it's just Goofus and another type of Goofus with Superman Returns in the heady summer of 2006. It was... both of those movies are disappointments that make Spider-Man 3 look like Godfather 2, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean, Spider-Man 3 is just sort of, there's like too much going on, and
Spider-Man
everyone's just kind of tired.
Spider-Man 3 is like Star Wars prequel bad, where you're like, oh, well, this is still like a loopy, dumb vision by a filmmaker. Like if James Gunn made a bad Guardians movie or something.
Right.
This is just like the studio being like, we are going to make a date and we are going to use whatever director sticks around long enough to yell, that's a wrap.
to get it done over the finish line. Yeah, exactly. I mean, X-Men 3 is possibly one of the worst comic book movies ever made, I think.
Yeah, well, it commits all the sins. It's hopelessly boring. It has too many villains. It stuffs three different plot lines into a single movie, and it feels smaller and cheaper than the other two X-Men movies that came before it that were visually smaller and cheaper movies than this.
Yeah, I mean, I think what helped, you know, so I guess we should get into, let's take it back, Sam.
Well, first, let's clear the air. We're talking about, first, a movie directed by Brett Ratner, who took over the X-Men franchise after Bryan Singer left to do Superman Returns. And Brett Ratner is a confirmed Hollywood scumbag, and he's going to maybe come up a couple more times on podcast part three, because lamentably he got his franchises to three movies or inserted himself into franchises in the third movie. But, you know, screw him. Yeah. Piece of shit. Similarly, we're going to talk about X-Men Apocalypse. Bryan Singer, ditto. We've already talked about him with Superman Returns. They're both garbage people. Yep. And these movies suck. So my claws are coming out.
Prepare for some vitriol, folks.
But quietly, because my kid's asleep.
Yeah. So let's start on a more positive note. Sam, how did you discover the X-Men?
Well, like any good millennial born in the mid '80s, I discovered them with the animated series in the early '90s. You know, because that's. I mean, there's a reason why it came back last year and people adored it, because that was like the pinnacle of, like, it's not the best animated superhero series. No. That's Batman from the 90s, at least. But it's definitely one of the most ambitiously written ones. And it's got a theme song that just kicks ass, and it looks like the Jim Lee era comics. And that was my entry into it. That, and there was a trading card set that was just all the rage there for a hot second.
Was it was that the one that you collected? Was it the one where they all connected to make a big picture, or was that a different
no,
one?
No, these were different. On the back was like a wireframe, almost like skeleton of the character the front. I don't know if it was like Upper Deck or like Leaf or someone like that. But those were all the rage in at Edward Devotion Elementary School in Brookline. I've besides that, I have only ever been a sporadic reader of the X-Men, because the X-Men exist in their own corner of the Marvel comic book universe, and they are complicated and soapy, and you can't really just get in midstream.
Yeah, to say the least. So my introduction to X-Men was actually the 1989 Pride of the X-Men pilot. I saw it on TV. I saw it when it aired.
Because it also tied into Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, because they show up in that, because Starfire was one of the X-Men.
Right.
Oh, and Iceman, of course. But it had the ridiculous but also prophetic Australian Wolverine.
Yeah. But yeah, I saw that when it aired on TV. So I was like probably 4, maybe 5 years old, and that aired, and I was like, what is this? And then I think some of the toys came out like a couple years later, and I had a Cyclops action figure and a Wolverine action figure. And
you had them both fall in love with a Barbie doll or something?
Of course. Why not? I mean, but then it wasn't until the animated series when I was all in on X-Men. And then when the movies started coming out, I read like the original Claremont run, or, you know, what was available at the time. Like, do you remember those Essential?
Oh, sure. Yeah. The black and white ones. Yeah. Yeah.
I got the volume 2 of that, which had Days of Future Past, the Dark Phoenix saga, and like a couple other like pretty, you know, famous runs. So I read all of those that the summer of 2000. So
I will say, in the defense of filmmakers, you open up and you're about 10 pages into Dark Phoenix. Say you're a screenwriter that's been hired by Fox. You were 10 pages and like, oh, we can't adapt this faithfully. We can't. Who the fuck are the Shi'ar?
Yeah, well, that's something we're gonna talk about.
His name's Gladiator? Is he a gladiator?
the Shi'ar Empire, the fucking Ronan the Accuser, I think, shows up in that arc.
It was the Kree, it was all the stuff. It was all like Guardians of the Galaxy stuff and Captain Marvel, if you're watching the MCU stuff, but in an X-Men story about the Phoenix, and she's like brought to be on trial on another planet, and none of this is in or honestly necessary to adapting the story of Jean Grey and the Dark Phoenix. I get why you simplify it. I will say that's my defense, is like, I get why you simplify it, especially when it's going to have to be essentially the C plot in a movie.
Right. So, I mean, what, to Bryan Singer's credit, I do think we need to say this, is that the thing that he did right with that, the first two X-Men movies, was he said, we are going to take this seriously. Not like serious, like, oh my god, it's a dirge, but we are going to take the struggles of the X-Men and their drama and everything as seriously as we would take like an indie drama. And I think that actually shapes shapes the way that comic book movies are told from 2000 onward.
Agreed. 100%.
You know, I mean, and again, Bryan Singer's a scumbag, but I think opening that first movie on a concentration camp sort of puts a flag in the sand, being like, this is a serious movie. We're taking this seriously. This is not just like some dopey fun thing.
And it didn't ever feel like it. That sequence never felt winking or trying to be edgy the way similar Holocaust stuff that came later in the series tried to be. Like, there's stuff in Apocalypse where at the same time where I just kind of feels like really forced.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I think that first X-Men movie has a lot of problems, and I think when you watch it now, you really do have to give it sort of like, you have to take it of its time.
Yeah, it's almost like watching like the first Evil Dead or something. Kind of like it's working with, you know, essentially like the charred remains of a genre in the wake of Batman and Robin, and trying to rebuild it from the ground up. And then the second one definitely, it's not necessarily like a bigger movie, but it's a way more confident movie.
Right. And I think that's the thing, because I think what the first movie gets right is casting. Well, mainly casting of Magneto, Xavier, and Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
I think on some points it gets the idea that this is supposed to basically be a Star Trek movie, but in, you know, a different setting. X-Men 2, I think, really understands, oh yeah, this is a Star Trek movie, everyone's got their own thing to do, and they're all gonna kind of, everything's gonna come together. There's an A plot and a B plot, and they kind of dovetail together, and that's, you know, that's the movie, and it works. I think X-Men 2 is probably one of the best comic book movies ever made. Would you agree with me on that?
I would agree, and it's very well paced. All the acting is great. Everyone gets a little showcase. The villain's really good without feeling like just sort of a bit, he's not a big CGI monster. You get like Brian Cox, and he's just being a great smarmy villain. And it's sets up, gets you excited for a sequel, because it starts to tee up the Phoenix. And, you know, I thought that movie when it came out, that was 2003. I thought that was fantastic when it came out. And I think watching it now, I would say it holds up pretty well, certainly the best of like the original three or four movies.
Yeah, I think it's the of that bunch, it's the best of them. I think it also holds up the best. I mean, obviously. So then, and it sets up the Phoenix, and I think it did something kind of interesting. And I think the only way that you can do it, if you're going to take away all the cosmic bullshit, is you have to have the Phoenix be some sort of, you know, multiple personality disorder or something within Jean's mind. I think that's actually sort of smart. And the second X-Men 2 sort of starts setting that up.
Yeah, as does X-Men Apocalypse, for that matter.
Well, right.
But then it tries to have it both ways in Dark Phoenix. So
yeah, and so we need to get there. And so, but then you get to X-Men 3, and part of the problem is that, as we've talked about on the show before, that when studio movies say you have to be this date, it has to be this date, and we're never moving it, that always spells doom.
And at the time, I guess it was Tom Rothman at Fox, like, Bryan Singer gets the opportunity to do Superman. That's his dream movie.
Right.
And, you know, that was your dream movie? But he goes off to do that, and they're basically like, come hell or high water, we are going to beat Superman Returns to the theaters, and we are gonna make our spring 2006 date,
right.
And we are gonna get Matthew Vaughn on board. He's coming off of I think he'd done Layer Cake, and he'd produced Guy Ritchie's early stuff, which people loved, like Lock, Stock, and Snatch, which were both really popular movies. And he came in, and I feel like within a matter of months, they'd completely drained him of all his life, and he had to step off the project.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was some family. I don't think it's ever been revealed what it was, but I think he did have like a family emergency.
Wikipedia says creative and personal issues.
Yeah, so there you go.
So, I mean, there's not a 0% chance that the family issues were just get me off this X-Men movie.
Mom, are you sick? Yeah? Okay, I'm going to say that I can't do this X-Men movie. But, it seems like, from what I've read, the script was thrown together incredibly fast for this, and it really shows.
Well, it's cramming together the Dark Phoenix saga, basically a final showdown with Magneto, and the Joss Whedon, at that time, fairly recent Joss Whedon Astonishing X-Men run that was all about the mutant cure. So we got Joss Whedon in the mix now, too. So it's just...
Well, he's sort of been in the mix from the beginning, too.
Yeah, he worked on the first script.
Yeah, and wrote the single worst line in any of these movies, which, despite what Joss Whedon says, I don't think there's any way you can pull that line off. Do you know what line I'm talking about?
The Toad line?
Yeah.
I've got it.
Okay.
It's got to be two different people that say it.
Yeah, yeah.
So... Storm's got him, and she looks to Wolverine and goes, do you know what happens to a toad when it gets struck by lightning? And then he basically zap, and then Wolverine or someone else is saying, same thing that happens to everything else, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the only way it can work, but also...
But that's way too winky James Gunn energy for what was going on in those X-Men movies.
Well, absolutely. And the bigger problem with the line, I think, is that Storm is barely a character in that first movie, so when she gets, like, a badass, like, one-liner, you're kind of like, it comes out of nowhere anyway. You know, it's sort of like, what is this? What's she doing? I think X-Men 3 is like a lot of part 3s that we've talked about. This is where all the problems of the previous two movies that had been held at bay for whatever reason come home to roost.
we've seen that before in certain Batman trilogies. I think that's the other problem, and maybe that's a problem with X-Men at large, where I don't know if I'm the only one that feels this way, but I personally think Jean Grey is boring as shit compared to every other female X-Men out there. Like, Storm has... Jean Grey is no one's favorite X-person.
No.
People like Storm. People like Rogue. People like Kitty Pryde. People like Mystique. People like Psylocke. The only thing... Unfortunately, I think Jean Grey is kind of like Gwen Stacy. Like, not Spider-Woman Gwen Stacy, just regular Gwen Stacy. She's really only known as the person that another character was in love with, and then she died. There just happens to be a big flaming bird there in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the problem... I mean, I think if you're going to do the Dark Phoenix saga or the Phoenix saga... I mean, I think the big problem with this movie, one of the big problems, is that you don't do the Phoenix saga, you just jump right to the Dark Phoenix saga. So there's no, like, fall from grace that you kind of need.
Yeah, but they completely... people forget that she was the Phoenix for a while in the comics.
Exactly. And, I mean, and you...
It's sort of like how you people forget, like, if you were doing it comic faithful, there'd be like two movies where Spider-Man had this black suit that he got from an alien.
Like a vending machine.
But it's no big deal. He doesn't know that it's a monster yet.
Yeah, exactly. But but Jean Grey isn't really a character. I mean, in the first two movies, it's kind of okay because she's sort of to the side.
Yeah.
but she doesn't like have an arc. She's okay. Just kind of part of this love triangle,
and it's barely a love triangle,
right? And that's yeah.
No one knows what to do with Cyclops, even though unlike Jean Grey, I think Cyclops has a ton of stuff you can do with him in the comics, independent of his love triangle.
Right,
and it's also they wanted the love triangle to be really that her true love is Wolverine, but really it's James Marsden. That's how it is. Like she does. And, like, she's supposed to be with Scott in the comics, not with Wolverine in the comics also is a tiny, ugly man.
tiny, hairy, smelly guy.
Tiny, hairy, smelly, ugly, ugly little man.
Even though women throw themselves at him all the time.
He doesn't know this because he predates the term, but he has Riz. It's one of his superpowers. Wolverine, even in the comics, has a great deal of what the kids call Riz.
Yes.
And when he's Hugh Jackman, obviously, it goes without saying.
Yes.
It's so funny to go back and watch those first three movies where he's not even remotely ripped. He's just so normal looking.
Yeah, he's just kind of like a little muscly, but not
and
and
he's hairy.
Yeah, you know. He is hairy. This movie... trying to shoehorn Dark Phoenix, which in the comics was like almost like lasted 3 years of monthly comics, right? It was something like that, or maybe 2 years, but it was a lot. It was a long story.
Yes.
And there was a lot that happened in it. And they shrunk this story down, which again, 3 years of monthly comics. And again, it also dealt with a lot of cosmic entities and weird, like, loopy acid trip Marvel shit.
It's stuff you would 100% need to simplify on the best of days.
Yeah, but it all, even if you had the MCU behind it and you had all this stuff established.
Yeah, no, it would take a trilogy of movies just about Jean Grey.
Exactly. But it also had like stuff with like the Hellfire Club, which they could have incorporated into this, you know, sort of the, you know, mutant guys trying to manipulate Jean Grey into doing what they want. Whatever. But instead, they relegate it to a C-plot of this, like, again, like you said, there's the Magneto plot, there's the Cure, and then there's Jean Grey. And Jean Grey basically sits around for most of the movie. She doesn't do anything. She just stands there.
She kills Cyclops. She kills off-screen, like, because James Marsden went off to be the hero of Superman Returns. and then she kills Professor X, which is the... killing him is kind of like... well. Professor X is one of those Omega level superhero characters where to show a villain is powerful, they take him off the board.
Right.
It's the two ways you show a superhero villain is powerful is if they're fighting the Justice League, the first thing they do is take out Superman. If you're fighting the X-Men, you take out Professor X. And if there's no character like that in the superhero team, the supervillain goes, "Enough!" and throws them off all at once. So if you can't take out the big gun, you use the enough move.
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, instantly a lot of the acting charisma goes away once Patrick Stewart bites it. But
everyone in the third movie everyone that's returning seems bored, except Ian McKellen, because he's finally getting to be villain full time. So his wonderful campiness kind of shines through. He still doesn't really get to, like, he's never given enough as Magneto as he gets as, like, Gandalf, even like when Gandalf was a smaller part in those movies. But, like, he's, you know, when you can tell he just relishes getting to be a villain in that one.
No, he really does. He is having a great time. And every time he's on screen, the movie sort of lights up around him and it, like, comes to life. But it's just the Cure storyline drives me crazy. And I didn't remember it driving me this crazy when the movie came out, but rewatching it for this, like, it drove me nuts. Especially what they do to Rogue, and especially how it, like, fucking breaks the allegory of the movie.
Well, no one has done more dirty in those movies than Rogue.
Right.
Like,
but I think
character.
Rogue especially, because she... so, her arc across three movies... presumably should have been, my powers are a curse, I've come to accept them, right? That should be her arc, right?
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
No, like, she should have showed up. No, it's Rogue should be, it should be across the trilogy. It doesn't have to be the A plot, doesn't have to be the main story, but it should be about Rogue turning into the Rogue we know in the comics, who doesn't give a fuck, wears a leather jacket, is, you know, crazy hot, and, you know, dates Gambit, like the cool Rogue.
Right.
She's absorbed a bunch of powers, she kicks ass, but instead they diminish her more and more. It's not Anna Paquin's fault. They don't give her anything to work with. And so in the last movie, she's like, I want to get rid of my powers. I have this chance to get rid of my powers. And the whole time, I remember this, the first time I was watching it, I was genuinely hoping she'd show up in the climax and still have her powers, grab Magneto by the neck and drain him of his.
Yeah.
In a callback to the original movie. See, right. It's like poetry. It rhymes. Right. You know?
No, I think a movie that hadn't been rushed may have actually gotten there.
Because in the novelization, she keeps her powers.
End. Really?
It's the same ending, but it was instead when he goes and Iceman goes to see her, and she's like, I had to do it, and they touch hands. In the novelization, it's the same thing, but she's like, I just couldn't do it, and she's still Rogue.
Oh my god, that's so frustrating.
So you know, it was like they shot it both ways. I guarantee you.
I'm sure they did. And what doesn't make it? I mean, okay. So on a certain level, it makes sense.
I also want to say the only other person in the movie that's got their acting boots on is Kelsey Grammer.
Oh yes, because
that's just inspired casting for Beast.
No, it was brilliant casting, and again, it's a character who does nothing. I mean,
he doesn't necessarily have to do anything,
right?
But that character in the comics is, and in the animated series especially, he's so erudite, even though he looks like a Sasquatch. And I think they actually do him more faithfully in Last Stand than they do with Nicholas Holt. Nicholas Holt's character is more well rounded, but feels nothing like Beast.
No, I agree, but But the thing is that, you know, the movies really present Rogue's powers as, like, the worst thing you could possibly want. So that by the time she, like, has the option to get rid of them, you're kind of like, yeah, you should get rid of those powers. You shouldn't have those powers. They suck. Your life sucks.
But even in the second one, you have a moment in there where she's starting to more control. Like, she uses them on Pyro, and she has more of a sense of control. It should be her learning to master those powers.
No, and that's the thing. I think that because that's what it's set up as. That's, like, the first act is, oh my god, these are a curse, and then the second act is, like, these are more of a burden to me. I can't believe I have them. I want to get rid of them. And then in the third one, it should be like, no, this is my gift. Which ties into the allegory of the story, right? But instead, in this movie, Rogue gets rid of her powers, and it sort of was like, okay, so our whole allegory is we want humans to accept us as who we are because of who we are. And
it's honestly, it's even worse than that, because it's really just, Kitty Pryde's here, and she's super cute. She's a mutant that can do hand stuff with my boyfriend, and I can't, and I want to do hand stuff with Iceman, so I'm going to completely change my DNA using some drug.
Yes,
so I could jerk off Iceman.
Yeah, I mean, basically. And then what's even so weird about the way that this stuff is framed is that it is basically shot, written, and edited like she is going to get an abortion.
Yeah.
And it drives me crazy.
And that's the kind of thing where you can tell the filmmakers thought they were being so clever, and they kept citing the concentration camp scene probably when pitching it, and it just does not work the same way at all.
No, because again, it's like no one had the time to sort of stop and think, hey, what is the allegory of X-Men, and why are we equating it to abortion? It's just like no one
it's like they were kind of, I'm guessing they were like, mutants used to be an allegory for AIDS, and it's, you know, and that doesn't work either, because the whole idea is, it's when you do it as an allegory for just LGBTQ stuff, like being a mutant is like realizing you're gay, right? Especially as a kid. At least that whole line in the second movie, which is a little cheesy, but in 2003 felt weirdly progressive, where she's like, could you try not being a mutant?
Yeah,
it's exactly that, because having AIDS, you don't master your AIDS and learn to take pride in AIDS. And an abortion is a difficult personal decision that a person makes.
Right.
It's not something that you use to fight crime, you know?
Right. It's one of those things where it's like they're trying to be too serious, and it just sort of breaks the premise in a way that it's just like, what are we doing here? Because especially in a movie where eventually they'll just be throwing flaming cars at each other. Well,
but it's also it adds this layer on top of what's already there, which is just this sort of gray lack of fun that's in the movie, right? Because very famously Tom Rothman always said, "I will never have giant robots in my movie," right? Which was just basically, "Oh, we're never going to get Sentinels." And Sentinels are big purple robots that hunt mutants, and they are a staple of the X-Men comics, and they're a comic booky thing. It's the line from the first movie, "Well, what would you rather have, yellow spandex?" And it's like, yes. This was 2 years before Iron Man, which changed the game and was like, oh, we can be colorful and comic booky and still tell a real story. You can have it. You can have the Batman and Robin comic book look while still being a movie.
A serious movie. Yeah.
Without being Batman and Robin.
Right. Exactly.
And so, you know, I think the later ones, the post First Class ones, are closer to that. They get to wear yellow at the very least. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, I mean, and it just, anyway, that's the part that really sort of, like, ground my gears, this watch.
It's just such a leaden movie, too.
It really is.
It's like, yeah. If we're, like, ranking movies where they wreck the Golden Gate Bridge, is it one of the worst ones?
Yeah, I think so.
It's not as good as Godzilla 2014, and it's no Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it's just... It's a movie that is, and again, because of what it's coming off of X-Men 2, which was so good, this is such a bad, like, bad, low, low bar.
And right out of the gate, it's also like, hey, those things that you liked in the prior movies, if you like Cyclops, even though he doesn't get a lot to do, gone. You like Professor X? Gone. You like Mystique? Gone, you know.
Oh, I mean, and Mystique is another one in this movie that they just do dirty.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and it's just like any.
Sorry, my dear, you can't hang out with us anymore.
It's just like, yeah, the whole Cure thing just fucks everything up in the way that it's designed in this movie. It's just.
Do like when she's on the prison truck and she's pretending to be the president. Like, what's her thinking there? Do you think the guy's like eventually going to be like,
whoa,
maybe that is the president.
Yeah, I mean, and there's so much of that, like, you know, edgy screenwriter thinking. It's like, oh, anyone can die. We're killing all the people off, you know? It's just...
And anyone we introduce, we're going to do fuck all with, so don't get excited that Multiple Man's here.
Or Angel. It's just
I forget every time. Even though the fucking opening of the movie is a child mutilating himself, and that's how we introduce Angel. Like, it's trying to be dark again, but it's just like... Angel's in the movie, and I forget it every time, even though he's played by your Hollywood doppelganger, Ben Foster.
That's true. And it's so funny. It's like this movie doesn't even crack 100 minutes, I think.
No.
Like, with credits. It's like,
you can tell that, I don't think it was stuff that was filmed, but I know that this was killed in the script stage a few times over. It's a mess. You know it's a mess right out of the gate, because it's just like everything about it feels off. There's characters that are just kind of standing there in the background, and they aren't really people, like Colossus. And
they just stand there and do nothing and kind of watch what's happening.
And it doesn't pay off on anything they set up in the first or second movie, really. It all feels so half-baked. And, you know, if you're excited coming out of the second movie for a Phoenix movie, you're getting 20 minutes of a Phoenix movie.
Yeah, and mostly just Jean Grey standing around looking sad.
Yeah, she's like, she's not even his primary heavy.
No.
Like, he's like, I don't need you to move the bridge, I can do that. I don't need you to fight anyone, I got Juggernaut for that, you know? I don't need you to set anything on fire, even though you're the Phoenix.
It's like, well, what are we doing here? And then also, man, I'm the Juggernaut, bitch! Like, the first time that, like, a meme was inserted into the...
I didn't even know that was a meme at the time. I just was like, why is he saying Juggernaut?
Juggernaut, you Juggernaut-y.
Also, Juggernaut's not a mutant.
Well, okay, yeah. But, I mean...
Crimson Band... They had room to establish the Crimson Bands of Sidorak. and the fact that he's someone's brother too, isn't he? Like Professor X's brother.
He's Professor X's like stepbrother, I think, or half brother. I don't know. But could you imagine if this movie, if it played out like sometimes like a bad version of a Claremont script, where it's like Juggernaut shows up, gives his backstory, and then you move on.
Only because at the end, where they set up that Charles Xavier has put his mind in another body, if we end the movie with Vinnie Jones bald and in the wheelchair.
Dubbed over with Patrick Stewart's voice. That would be amazing.
You're not the only one with gifts.
Oh, man.
So this movie kind of, like, killed the X-Men movies for a hot second. Well, or no, it was like, okay.
Because it made a lot of money, actually.
Yeah, it did. It was a huge hit. Because we've been over this. A Tokyo Drift aside, the summer of 2006 wasn't giving us much.
No, there was not a lot going on then.
No, Hollywood was just waiting for its sea change, because the prior year had been Batman Begins, and the following year is Spider-Man 3, which ends this phase of superhero movies.
Right, yeah.
And kind of also sends the X-Men movies into the wilderness a little bit, because they start developing the X-Men Origins movies, one of which was Wolverine, which came out and is the goofiest shit you'll ever see.
I mean, I think I said it on the podcast, but it's basically five movies in a trench coat.
It is the Vincent Adultman of movies. It really is so funny.
It is like bananas how over the place.
Like
that
movie one
is.
I can watch and laugh at because it's gotten it's so hilariously bad. It's so poorly executed and.
Yeah, it's like every choice, every single creative choice was the wrong one. Every single one across the board.
And it's another classic movie that thinks it's so cool. And so the other one was X-Men Origins Magneto, which kind of became the first act, more or less, of X-Men First Class. Yep. And they brought Matthew Vaughn back, and they relaunched the franchise in what's sort of like a prequel, but not really a prequel, and don't try to figure out the timeline too much. It'll break your brain.
Yeah.
But that was like a kind of shot in the arm, and it's a movie that a lot of people love, a lot of people like. I like parts of it. I like a lot of the cast. You know, I think Fassbender's great as Magneto. Jennifer Lawrence is really good. James McAvoy is good. That in turn sets up Days of Future Past, which is like, let's do one famous X-Men story at once.
Yep.
And that brought back Bryan Singer, who was not canceled yet. And that felt like, okay, they figured this out. Like they closed the book on the old guard. They've set up the new ones properly.
And that one sort of takes the, well, we're going to do a Star Trek movie, but in a different setting, like approach to these things.
Well, it's a classic Star Trek time travel movie.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I mean. And it really feels more like an ensemble piece than it does sort of feel like the, in the prequel movies, the Xavier Mystique Magneto show.
The saga of the new younger X-Men cast is the saga of Jennifer Lawrence becoming such a big star that she really kind of wishes she hadn't signed that four-picture deal to play the naked, blue, scaly mutant character.
Yes.
And then Days of Future Past also, like, it brings back Hugh Jackman, and he's your audience surrogate, so he's in every scene, but the movie's not about him.
About him, exactly.
And they pulled off a very good trick with that movie, and I think made it work in a way that a lot of also period superhero movies don't always work. Like, I think it works in the 70s better than First Class works in the 60s or Apocalypse works in the 80s.
Yes. So I don't know whose idea it was to set these movies 10 years apart, a decade apart after each of them, but they should be roundly kicked in the shins, because I think it is a terrible decision.
Well, it's just confusing as hell.
Right.
It's like, because all right, so X-Men Apocalypse is set, 20 years after First Class?
Right.
And features characters that we introduced in First Class who ostensibly now should be in their mid to late 40s. Like, Havoc has a younger brother in high school and is conservatively supposed to be 30 years older than him. He's Lucas Till, so they're like the same age. But it just doesn't make any sense. And it's pointless too, because all it is we want to make a reference. I know which clip I'm using.
Yeah,
by the
of
way.
Course you do. Yeah.
We all know the third one's the worst. But they're also going to see Return of the Jedi. That's a good movie. They should have had a wonderful time.
Yeah, it's like one of those things where, like, a movie, unless it's like a strict comedy, a movie making fun of another movie always sort of feels like a bad omen. Because it's always like, oh, come on.
Well, you know, to quote Mystery Science Theater, never show a good movie in the middle of your crappy movie.
Exactly.
But it's also, it just wants to have 80s shit. It's like, oh, we can put Jubilee in like a yellow fringe jacket, and we can play Eurythmics during Quicksilver's scene, and that's it. It doesn't even have something, it's not even hinging on a historical moment in the 80s. Like the first one's the Cuban Missile Crisis, the second one's the end of the Vietnam War. It's just 80s bullshit.
It's the 80s vibe. I mean, had Stranger Things come out when Apocalypse came out? Maybe that was sort of like...
Maybe, but I think it's also just like, well, we did the 60s, we did the 70s, we got out of the 80s, you know?
Yeah. It's so annoying. It's so dumb. Yeah. And then...
It's annoying because it's also...
Sorry, go ahead.
We're getting into it. Because Last Stand is like... We've been talking about Last Stand for 20 years, and there's not much left to say. This movie is one of the
fresher.
Most... This is 2016. This is 10 years later, and it's coming off of like arguably two of the best X-Men movies, and it's the same director who had directed three of the most successful X-Men movies, and it comes out, and right immediately, it looks like shit.
It looks awful. Looks so cheap.
It's not quite on X-Men Origins Wolverine's level, but it looks ridiculously bad. Like, it looks like all the things you hear about, like, visual effects artists being pushed to their limit, and it's showing in the final product. This is also 7 or 8 years before that was really happening.
Right.
Or at least that we knew about it.
We knew about it.
And it just, it visually is a mess. And this is also, we are introducing, like, the one character... the one villain in the X-Men saga who would be an even bigger deal than the Dark Phoenix. Like, he's a Thanos-level villain. And looks like fucking Ivan Ooze.
It is so funny to watch Oscar Isaac's expressions in this movie. He looks like he wants to be anywhere else.
This is definitely like someone tricked Oscar Isaac into taking, like, his... this is... complete conjecture on my part, but he must have had one agent and then another agent, because for a time he was my least favorite actor in all of Hollywood, because he'd done the Robin Hood movie with Russell Crowe where he declared him to be an outlaw, and he'd done fucking Sucker Punch,
right.
Which is one of my least favorite movies, and ends with where I'm not going to get into it, but like, look, you think the scantily clad girls fighting zombies is cool? Well, it's literally a double layer metaphor for rape. And the rapist gets a song and dance number at the end. And I hate it.
Well, if you watch the extended cut, the song and dance number is in the middle. I don't know if that makes it any better, but...
Oh, well, and so it's diegetic in that case. That makes it all better, Will. So he did those movies, and then he did, like, there was a turn, and he did, like, Drive and Inside Llewyn Davis. And I was like, who's this guy? I like this guy. This guy's really good. And it's so, but then, his first agent must have just tricked him one day into signing on this. Because he looks ridiculous. He's the worst villain so far in the X-Men franchise in look and development and performance, because you have to get up to the, like, Brian Cox's level at least, to say nothing of Ian McKellen.
I mean, and part of the problem is, and this is a problem in the comic books, is that Apocalypse's powers and what he can do are so ill-defined.
It's a separate drop-down menu on Wikipedia from the rest of his information. It's just his various superpowers. I took the liberty of looking it up, because I thought... Abilities, C-list, reveal. Notable aliases, the first one, Genesis, and Sabanur, Set, Sarau, Kalima, Huitzilopochtli, and Eternal One. Abilities: biomorphing. That's his main ability. Genius level intellect, superhuman strength, speed, stamina, endurance, durability, agility, reflexes, resilience, dexterity, and senses. Force field, parentheses, technology. It's the one thing he can't do. Energy and matter manipulation, flight, immortality, invulnerability, telekinesis, teleportation, telepathy, technopathy, and the ability to augment, manipulate, or steal the powers of other mutants and cosmic beings. This is like someone took someone playing a game on the playground and they keep adding powers so they always win, turned into a comic book character.
Right, and so, like, usually an apocalypse story is, like, him taking over the world and then everyone having to time travel to stop it.
Age of Apocalypse is exactly that. It's like Days of Future Past. It's an alternate universe where he rules, and he has his four mutant horsemen who have rotated throughout the years in the comics, but are, you know, like, this is, like, again, like Phoenix, this one is ultra-simplified, but in a way that it makes it makes it seem such so nothing, especially compared to they just did a horrible alternate bleak apocalyptic future story, so they probably didn't want to do another one, but then just don't do Apocalypse.
Right, exactly. And it's one of those things where in trying to simplify him, they made him infinitely more complicated and confusing. You know, it's like, you're just like, what am I, why is, and you, it, at the end of the day, he basically just turns into, like, Arnold Vosloo from The Mummy. Like, that's all his powers are. It just, like, seems to me, right?
Well, he's starting to, like, he's doing something and dissolving Sydney, Australia, but, and it's, he's really just there to, like, he's just like, I'm the first mutant and I'm gonna, the world's gonna get a do-over.
Yeah, and it's it's such a vague plan and a vague threat, and it's so, like, it also doesn't help that Oscar Isaac is just buried under this horrible makeup, and it makes him, and the way that his face is painted, he looks like he's frowning.
Well, it's because Apocalypse has, like, a weird kind of, like, Tin Man from the Wizard of Oz jaw in the comics, and they were trying to have that, but also have him have it, like, look more humanoid. And it's Oscar Isaac just looks like, yeah, like you said, he wants to be anywhere else. The best stuff with Apocalypse in the movie is when he's, so the opening is in ancient Egypt, and humans rise up and, like, bury him for centuries and kill his horsemen, and that's, like, opening credits go through time, and now it's, you know, the 80s. And he's woken up, and the best stuff, in my opinion, is when he's still, like, old, like, he's weakened, and he's wandering around, and he doesn't speak English, and he's just trying to figure out what's happened to the world.
Right.
And then he, like, watches TV for 20 minutes, and it's all sort of
learning!
After he Storm lets him, like, stay at her place. Because Storm's in this movie.
Right. I mean, and they want to sort of introduce sort of the classic X-Men roster. That's the other thing they do, is they redo Cyclops' introduction from X-Men Origins Wolverine, but with a different actor now.
Which is also,
it's basically like shot for shot the same thing.
Which was filmed for the first X-Men. The same thing. That means they have filmed him going off in a bathroom stall three times. They reused that bathroom stall set in X-Men 2 for when Mystique inserts all the iron into the guy's blood. You can tell if you look closely, the bathroom door has, like, char marks on it.
Oh.
So they have just, some filmmakers, like, you gotta have a mutant get his powers onto John. Because it's like when you're a kid and you go through the puberties. And it's the first time you sit under John and you're like, I'm gonna jerk off. And you shoot. And it just wrecks the door. This is a true story that happened to me. What do you mean I can't come with those guys to Disney?
And then the other actor in the cast who clearly doesn't want to be there is Jennifer Lawrence, who looks so bored through the whole movie.
She's, what, two Oscar noms in at this point? She's like, I am done.
Had she won her Oscar at this point, too?
She'd been not... She did... She got nominated for Winter's Bone and then got cast in the first one, First Class. Like, she was a huge A-list star at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and it's not an A-list part. The movie is not about her. Like, Days of Future Past is about Mystique, and it's still kind of a thankless part for her because she's still just kind of being, like, knocked around by everyone else and doesn't get to wear clothes.
Yeah, but in this one, it's, the script does her no favors anyway, and so, but, like, she doesn't do anything in this one either. No. It's not about her. She kind of, like, bumbles through things. At least this one has one storyline, but it just doesn't, nothing coheres.
It has a ton of cul-de-sacs, though.
It really does.
Like, I've seen this movie maybe three times, and it goes in one ear and out the other. So every time I'm like, oh, I forget we spend, like, a whole middle act at the Weapon X facility, with where our good buddy Wolverine might stop by to wish him luck.
Yeah, it's and like just because like the story, nothing happens.
I'll do the part. Do I have to change out of my cargo shorts?
No, just put this funny thing on your head.
Well, fuck's sake.
Yeah, and nothing happens in this movie. Like, nothing, like, of consequence happens. Professor X goes bald. Like,
yes, this is the story of how he went bald. that's it. He went bald because he thought he had just too big a thought one day, having to deal with apocalypse in his head.
I did like that sort of, because that's such a Marvel Comics thing where it's like, here's this battle in my mindscape. I kind of like that. That was kind of fun. But
well, it's also that, it's not that he's going bald from the psychic strain. He's just going bald because Apocalypse is putting his powers into him, and Apocalypse is bald, and the prior Apocalypse had been bald. So I guess Apocalypse just likes that smooth dome.
Yeah, he doesn't want to deal with hair.
No.
He doesn't want the choices of making a hairstyle. He just wants to, wake up and not worry about it.
That goes into the fact that, like, even if you're a mutant, presumably occasionally he has to go to the bathroom. And that just ties back to, like, Apocalypse on the John is like when Michael Myers has to use he needs his horseman to get, like, all his shit off of him.
Come on, take off my pants. I need you to take off my robot pants.
It's not sexual. I drank like three Fruitopia.
I wish that Oscar Isaac had tried to do Apocalypse's voice from the cartoon, because that was so weird, that voice.
Oh, I don't even remember it.
I'm Apocalypse. I don't know.
He's Frankenstein?
He kind of. But
you know, he's got some modulation going on. Again, it's like, you wouldn't even know. He feels less like Oscar Isaac in this fully practical getup than, like, Josh Brolin does as Thanos, or even James Spader does as Ultron, who is a full-on robot.
Yeah, it is. Oh my god, it is baffling. There are so many weird choices. I mean,
that are so counter to the things that have been set up in the prior movies. It just feels like they're obviously trying to Marvel it up hard at this point.
Yeah,
you know, we're two Avengers movies deep into the MCU by 2016, and it's just like
Everything in this movie has to be big and epic, and, like, everything is huge, and it's just, and it, like, it becomes numbing at a certain point.
They want their Thanos, but Marvel took fucking 10, 12 movies to set up Thanos, along with a whole lot of other things. If you want to do it, you have to really pace yourself. Yeah. Like, Apocalypse should have been a thing in the background of the prior two movies.
Right, if that's what you're going to do. And then the thing is that this just suffers the same problems that the original movies had, where it's like, they give nothing for Jean Grey to do and nothing for Cyclops to do. I mean, they give them, like, stuff, but it's not, like, anything emotional that you can connect to the characters with. They're just sort of there, and then,
I think also the problem is with a superhero movie, sometimes it's they mistake an emotional arc for just, what are they going to do with their powers in the third act?
And right, exactly.
Look, Cyclops's powers are he has one of Superman's powers. That's it. And all the things that are interesting about the X-Men are independent of their powers, with a few exceptions. Like, when it's Rogue and her powers aren't really, like, a cool superpower. They're a hindrance to her having a normal life. That's where the mutant thing comes in. But being a mutant is that the arc of being a mutant and fitting into society is independent of their superpowers for doing superhero shit.
Right. And the thing that, you know, the best X-Men stories get is that these guys, it's basically a soap opera with superpowers. And it's more about the interpersonal relationships and how these people interact with each other. And it's really hard to take in a movie that is, I guess, the third movie in this reboot franchise as, like, we're going to reset the table and here are some new characters you need to meet.
All I can think of, and this would never have happened because they've tried at least three times to do X-Men shows and they've, like, Legion is cool, but it's very, very different. Like,
yeah.
The Gifted didn't really move the needle. There was that Generation X pilot in the 90s.
Right, right.
But, if they'd done with the X-Men what the CW did with its DC properties, I think it would have worked really well. It should be like a CW type, you know, drama, like soapy drama with superheroes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's why the cartoon and the comics worked so well, is that, you know, it was telling serialized stories, but they were basically soap operas. I mean,
and also almost all of the big X-Men storylines are very long, drawn-out soap operas, except
right.
Days of Future Past, which is like three issues.
Yeah, yeah. If that, I think it might even just be two. But yeah,
yeah. And that's the one you can adapt, and so that's why it was way more successful than the either take on the Phoenix or
right.
Apocalypse.
Yeah, I mean, and my problem with Dark Phoenix the movie is that it has all the same problems that Last Stand has. It's just, like, where it just can't sort of figure out how to make Jean Grey interesting.
And we have no money at this point.
And then at that point...
And Jennifer Lawrence will not come out of the trailer until she's been given the pages where she firmly dies.
Yes, yes.
And also, we're going to work the aliens in now, and it's too deep in the franchise and doesn't make any sense anymore.
But they're going to work them in such a half-assed way, too. It's not even like, it's like, oh my god, it is, that movie is so baffling as like, I mean, I know that it also was like, Fox had been swallowed up by Disney at that point, so it was kind of...
That was, that one and New Mutants are coming in at the end. They're just like, well, we might as well finish this, you know?
Yeah.
It's a shame. It's a shame that, like, the promise of First Class and Days of Future Past didn't pan out into a couple more really fun movies before they had to shutter everything and port the anchor character over to the other timeline. But it's a franchise that has some high highs and some low lows, and their part threes happen to be really low points that also were shepherded by some truly detrimental, reprehensible people.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's anything that works in these movies works better in X-Men, X2, First Class, and Days of Future Past. It's as simple as that.
Well, and by the time you get to Apocalypse, I mean, it's basically just reheated leftovers of all the other, of the good scenes from the other movies. So it's like, you know, you get your Quicksilver scene, which is kind of cool, but it's not as cool as the one that happened in Days of Future Past.
No, the novelty's worn off. They don't have anything new or fresh. It's like,
no.
They've got Olivia Munn looking really bored as Psylocke. And, and then, like, characters, you just don't, no one cares about Angel. I'm sorry.
No one cares. But also, they can't figure out what to do with Angel in any version of this franchise. It's sort of, I mean, maybe in the comics they could, but it's like, in this, it's like, oh, he's here. Look, it's Angel. He's got wings. Do we care about him? No, not really. Anyway, moving on.
He's got wings. Are they cool wings? They're bird wings, you know?
And then he gets metal wings in this one, but you're kind of like, what are we doing? This character does nothing.
Well, that happened in the comics when he becomes Archangel after he is freed from the thrall of Apocalypse. But yeah, no, I mean, we have one more part three X-Men movie to do, and we're gonna get to it, and it's much better. It's not maybe it's not like the funnest movie in the world, but it's leaps and it's the best X-Men movie probably in terms of just execution.
Yep.
But before we get to that, I don't know if you all have noticed, but it's October. Which means
spooky,
it's time.
Season.
Shriekwool threequel season.
Oh.
We got four. We got four picked out, and they're doozies. Will, what's first?
Omen 3, We're going to watch Sam Neill run around and be the Antichrist. I don't know. I've never seen it, but
he's
going to
fight Jesus. it's The Omen. It's you know, it's kind of like The Exorcist, or not The Exorcist. It's like Psycho. It's like, hey, did you know there were Omen sequels? There's like 3-4 of them. There's a prequel, you know.
And a remake.
And a remake. Also from summer 2006.
Oh, yeah.
6606.
That's right. The Fox executives, when they figured that out, were like, oh yeah,
that's summer, man.
That summer sucked. Oh,
like that was, what was that? There was the Poseidon Adventure remake. Was that summer?
Oy. That was a bad summer. I worked at a movie theater that summer.
You know what movie I saw the most that summer? Fucking what? Inconvenient Truth. Because I was living in New York that summer, and I went to the movies all the time, and I saw like, I just remember there were some days where it was blazing hot and the theater near me was showing Inconvenient Truth. So I think I went twice, and then I went to see like the Prairie Home Companion movie. They had the Strangers with Candy movie was that summer.
Yeah.
It was a weird summer, and I lived right near Union Square, so I was going to the big multiplex over there.
Was The Longest Yard that summer, or was that the... No, that was the previous summer. No, that was 2005.
No, 2006 was Click, was the Adam Sandler movie.
Right, right, yeah.
And Little Miss Sunshine was that summer.
Oh, yeah, and Cars.
Yes, I saw Cars. Brick came out that summer, Ryan Johnson's Brick. Can't win every summer. But, yeah, so we're going to start with Omen 3, and it's got my favorite. I love Evil Sam Neill. You know,
yeah,
if you only know
best.
Him from Jurassic Park, he's played crazy villains in a bunch of horror movies, and it's always great. So, and it's also, I believe, the longest of the four movies we're watching this October at 100 minutes. Everything else may or may not crack 90 minutes. My gift to myself.
Our time is limited these days, so it's always good to have shorter movies.
Oh, this was a lot of movie to watch in chunks, these two.
Yeah, they're tough.
It's like, I'm like 10 minutes, I finished Last Stand, I'm 20 minutes into Apocalypse, and I'm like, well, how much do I really like doing this podcast?
Just think of you know,
because I've been catching up, like we've caught up on a bunch of stuff we did this over the spring and summer, all those episodes, and I'm listening to us talk about Planet of the Apes, and I'm even listening to us talk about Tokyo Drift, and there's like a fondness, and then this is just like, oh.
Yeah, these two movies are a real slog.
Is like, oh, I gotta go help Apocalypse poop again. It's like that.
Gotta pull down the robot pants, sit him down, calm himself. Take a deep breath, Apocalypse. Come on, I know you can do it. No, I will not. Sorry, that's my son.
I was gonna say, are we still talking about Are we still talking about En-Sabanur here?
No, that was my son potty training. No, I don't have to go potty.
Well, my little Dark Phoenix still goes in a diaper, so, you know.
Just you wait! Will,
we had a taco party at the building 2 days ago, and she ate, I shit you, no pun intended, I shit you not, probably 30 ounces of black beans, like full fucking cups of black beans, and... since then she's been working on a project. We'll just leave it at that. This kid puts away black beans like they are going out of business.
Amazing.
That is her super, that's her mutant power, is she has like a portal to the negative zone in her stomach just for black beans. And Blastar the Living Bomb Burst is on the other end, and he's demanding all the black beans that Del Monte can provide.
You are punchy tonight.
These movies suck. Like, you know me, I am so gentle when I come across a movie I don't enjoy. I try to be really nice, but I have not had a good night's sleep in 5 years. I have a almost 2-year-old, and before that I had a dog who went blind right before the pandemic and would wake up 3 times a night thinking it was time for his breakfast. So, Will, I'm so tired, and I'm very excited that it's horror movie season, because those things are so much easier to watch than these superhero movies.
It's true. I think we also, aside from some of the really bad superhero movies, I think we have more to talk about with the horror movies.
True. Well, we talk about the superhero movies all the time. True. And there's like a couple still that we haven't gotten to. We haven't really done the MCU yet.
No.
Like
we've danced
around the multiverse a bit, but you haven't really gotten into the part threes. But honestly, those are, you know, that's going to be a whole conversation. And some of those are some of my favorites in the MCU. But, you know, you got to space it out with other stuff. And we also have some big guns we have not gotten to yet.
Yes, some truly big guns.
But until then, Will, yes, you're right. This is always fun to talk about. And if I'm going to be punchy with anyone talking about the worst Oscar Isaac has to provide, it's going to be you.
Hey, our friendship was founded on a mutual love of bad movies. So
it's true,
you know.
But yeah, folks, hope you're having a good start to the fall. Stay warm where it's cool. Stay cool where it's blazing hot, like here in Los Angeles. And it's now you can buy Halloween candy at Target. It's not weird like if you bought it a month ago when it first hit the shelves. Now you can go nuts. It's October. And we will see you next time for the third Omen and for Shriekwell season coming up after that. You're going to get 4 horror movies from us.
Woohoo!
Woo! Bye, folks.
Bye.
Bye.